folks, and welcome or welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast was brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis, a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for the past 2 decades, 8 years of which he's been actively buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in the city on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So his company has a dedicated loan officer in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions. So you're probably already aware that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or if you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on emil.gorgis, that's emil.gorgis, emil.gorgis@tokyorealty.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, this is an audio recording of a conversation that I've had recently with an Australian gentleman. He's married to a Japanese national, and we had a really long deep dive into the nitty-gritty aspects of property investment here in Japan. We talk about how to get an investment loan or a home loan, how the borrowing capacity and loan criteria is calculated, the ability or inability, rather, to draw on equity here. And then we branch into reselling properties. So do you do it after a shorter or longer holding period? The difference in investment mentality and general property ownership mentality between the Japanese and the non-Japanese. Why and how to sell your investment property, how these properties are priced. And also a whole lot about portfolio structuring, diversification across the country, across different countries, across continents, attractive locations to purchase in. And then we go off the reservoir, so to speak, and we dive into some more niche topics like parking lot investments, buildings versus units, Abenomics, and more current economic trends, including salaries and rent hikes, commercial, residential, the difference between the two, the cost of taxes and accountants in Japan. And we even touch on migration from the city to suburban and rural areas, and other pandemic-related trends. So really good, deep conversation, both micro and macro. Trust you'll enjoy it. I'll see you again on the other side. Yep, go for it. So I haven't got your email in front of me. I closed out of Outlook to avoid those bloops. So can you give me a brief intro on what you're looking for again?
Obviously, I'm Australian, and my wife is Japanese. She's there. I'm here at the moment. Hopefully I'm coming over next month, fingers crossed. But yeah, I've obviously have the Australian mentality, which owning property is important, and see the advantages of it. So I'm wanting to sort of do that in Japan. I'm meeting with the classic Japanese mindset that no, you don't own a property, you just rent, because of all of the costs involved and all you have to repair, etc.
Investment is dangerous and scary, yeah.
Investment is very dangerous and scary, yes. Yeah. But I'm looking to sort of build a moderate property portfolio with sort of like over a 10-year vesting period. That's sort of the broad strokes. On a sort of side note, I'm also interested in parking lots. Now, I have a very good family friend, Japanese family friend. They're based in Yokohama, and they basically live off the income from a couple of parking lots that they own, sort of downtown Yokohama. So I know that's an option. You discussed that on one of your podcast episodes.
Yep.
And I guess specifically today, what I'm really interested in is financing. I've listened extensively and read your articles that you provided. Also, I'm very aware of the difficulty of getting loans and not taking into account foreign equity, etc.
Or foreign income, unfortunately.
Or foreign income.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that if we maybe went into the weeds a little bit, and were there any sort of creative strategies of financing sort of purchases that you may be aware of? For example, having a foreign bank and getting financing through them.
That's doable, but it's not going to be, in most cases that I'm aware of, it's not going to be a property loan. So it's going to be like a business credit line or a personal loan.
Yes.
And the terms are just not really that attractive when you get those. Yeah.
No.
The only other option would be for, can I ask about your employment status? Are you employed? Are you a business owner? What do you do?
Yeah, so I have my own business, sort of self-employed.
Yep.
I actually, one of my businesses was a Japanese travel business. Obviously, that's been decimated thanks to that current situation we all keep hearing about daily. But I've sort of battened down the hatches a bit, and I've done quite well out of the property market here locally in Australia. I own property in Brisbane, which has just seen unbelievable growth. I actually made 50% return in 3 years. So
it's amazing.
It's amazing, and it's crazy, and it's actually become unaffordable in the major cities in Australia. So if I can use that money to come across to Japan and sort of start building something substantial there, that's what I'm very, very interested in.
Yeah, well, financing wise, I mean, the only case that I know of where a person actually got a straight out property loan from a foreign lender to invest in Japan, so cross border, was somebody whose family had substantial wealth and have been banking with that same bank for many years. And that's the sort of thing you get in Europe and Singapore, not that much in Australia.
No.
So family offices, obviously large investment corporations and so forth. For normal individuals who don't have extensive private banking connections, that's usually not an option. So if we put that aside for a moment and focus on Japanese lenders, for them to lend to you, you would need to have an income history in Japan for at least, I mean, the official minimum is a year, but I'd say probably better to go off 3-4 years. And it has to be stable income. So if it's a salary, it has to be a stable salary. And if you're a business owner, the business has to be paying you a taxable salary, or you need to be drawing a taxable income from the business.
Mm-hmm.
And again, over a period of a few years, and relatively stable, so no big fluctuations. I mean, if it keeps going up, it's great. But if it goes up and down, that's going to be an issue for them.
Yes.
And you would need to either have residency, long-term residency, so beyond a spouse visa or a working visa, or have a Japanese resident as a co-signatory to the loan.
Yes.
Yeah. The only other options, I mean, there are a couple of banks that would lend to non-resident foreigners or somebody who they classify as a non-resident. But they would only be lending for very, what they perceive as very safe and stable investments. So central Tokyo properties that are purely residential properties for long-term leases, no short-term stays, definitely not parking lots or any sort of business venture. And those are just, well, A, they're very expensive. So for the price of the deposit that you'll need to put in, which is going to be 30-40%, you could already purchase a couple of properties just straight out in cash.
Yeah.
Because central Tokyo properties, or even central Osaka, which they sometimes branch out to, tend to be very expensive. And yields are dismally low. I mean, they're not bad cash on cash if you factor in how much you're actually putting in out of pocket. But compared to what you can get in other parts of the country, or
you know, different profile of property. And the other thing is that they necessitate that they, for the life term of the loan, they force you to work with their designated property managers just to make sure that you're not doing any monkey business and renting it out short term, which is against the loan terms, which just sort of creates a situation where if for some reason you're not happy with that property manager, there's nothing that you or us can do about it. You have to keep working either with them, or maybe they've got one or two alternative companies that they can put in place, but you don't have the freedom of choice on the property, and you don't have the freedom of choice on usage, and you don't have the freedom of choice on management. So considering all of these terms, we don't actually have any clients who wanted to go for that. I keep referring them to them, and they keep having the conversation with the banks, but no one's pulling the trigger because, I mean, it's just, it's horrible terms, right? Yeah. And the interest also is going to be very different. So the interest for a non-resident loan is somewhere between 2.5 to 3.5, maybe 4%. Whereas if you're borrowing normally as a resident from a normal Japanese lender, you get for investment maybe 1.5, maybe 2% if they, you know, your high risk profile for them. Mm-hmm. So it could come up to almost double the interest rate.
Which does make a difference.
Yep.
So basically, as an example, I could come. I think you've mentioned in your podcast before, come with $300,000 to $400,000 US equivalent, buy sort of 5 to 10 potentially. Properties diversified across Japan.
If you want to spread them out, you could also buy one small building, which gives you more capital growth potential and more flexibility. And because the whole structure is yours, you can basically do almost everything you want with it under local zoning regulations. But basically, you could definitely rent rooms out by the month as opposed to by the year or 2 years. If down the track you wanted to tear down walls, turn some of the units into bigger units, which is very doable with a wooden structure, which is most of the smaller buildings in Japan, you'd have the freedom to do that. Even, you know, tear the whole thing down and make it a parking lot or logistics facility or whatever you want. Obviously, you're not going to be able to do that with individual units.
No. I think I probably already know the answer to this question, but, it would be more advantageous for my personal cash flow as if I came with half that amount, 150,000 to 200,000 US, and then try to get a loan for the rest, and then sort of gear it in a way that I can pay that off fairly quickly just on the rental income.
Get a loan from Australia, you mean?
Well, Japan obviously would be better because the rates, but that's the difficulty. And as you've mentioned before, a Japanese national is generally lent, is it 7 times the annual salary?
That's for a home loan. Investment loans might be a bit different.
They might be less, I think, yeah.
Yeah, they might be less, and you definitely need to put in a lot higher of a cash participation. For home loans, they give you 100 or 105% to include purchase costs. With investment loans, it's going to be 50 to 60% usually. Maybe 70% if you're lucky. So you're going to be 30 to 50% in cash anyway. And again, that's not going to be an option until you've established an income stream in Japan and taxable income for a good few years, right? So for example, when you set up a business, depending on what sort of business you're going to be setting up, obviously you're going to be wanting to carry your setup costs, or if you're purchasing property, you want to carry your purchase costs forward and claim them as losses, deductions for the first few years tax-wise. But if you do that, you don't have taxable income. So again, the banks are not counting those years. So there's a very delicate balance. We can work on that with an accountant, but what's going to be your employment or business situation once you do relocate to Japan? What's the plan there?
Not 100% sure, because of the current environment. I would like to keep the tourism sort of thing happening in some state, but that's become inherently risky based on recent events. So not 100% sure.
But you're setting up a business. You're not planning to be employed here.
Setting up a business. That's sort of the goal. Yes. Rather than being employed. My wife is employed in Japan. It's a Japanese company. So.
And she's not going to be taking out the loan or co-signing the loan based on the mentality that you mentioned there.
I'm sure if it's just as I said, yeah, it's the mentality. This like it's not front of their mind. It's it's too risky. It's just something they're not even thinking about. But I think if you have an open mind and look at the numbers and the possibilities, a lot of that fear can be allayed. And so
maybe
basically got to come armed with all of the right information and.
Okay, so let's take the most likely scenario is that you're going to be setting up some sort of business here in Japan. Just going on business fundamentals, usually an income that would be considered, reasonable taxable income would probably take about 2 years to establish, I'm guessing.
Yes.
So you're looking at maybe qualifying about 5 years down the track. And that's assuming that your residency situation is somehow sorted. So I know that for home loans, some of the lenders do consider people who are on the route to permanent residency as opposed to people who are already there. But again, that's going to be a 40-60 kind of situation. They're not going to give you 100% if you're not a permanent resident. Mm. And also, I don't think many of them would consider investment loans. So you would also have to take care of your residency situation. I mean, you can be on a spouse visa or a business manager visa indefinitely, but that's probably not going to be good enough for the banks. They'll want you to be on a longer term visa, permanent resident or long-term resident. There's a few visas in that category.
Mm-hmm.
And that depending on, I can put you in touch with an immigration lawyer and he can try to see if you qualify for anything that'll be on a faster track. But normally you'd need to, again, generate a substantial enough income for the immigration department to consider cutting the period, which is normally 10 years, cutting it down to 4 or 5 or 6 years or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's, I see that they have amended the rules recently for the permanent residency. It's like a 100-point system now. Obviously you've got a Japanese spouse that gets you a long way there and then, having maybe a business manager visa or degrees in certain
look income areas. Income always helps. High taxable income is always the fastest track. But again, from a tax perspective, you probably don't want to declare a high taxable income if you can avoid it for as long as you can. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a
bit of a catch-22 there. Yeah.
Bit of a catch-22, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it doesn't matter if I bring the cash and deposit in a Japanese bank, it just doesn't matter. They're not interested in that.
No, they don't care about cash deposits, they don't care about assets in other countries, not even in Japan. All they care about is a stable income stream and the history of that, and residency status. Unfortunately. So assuming that that's all going to maybe become an option, let's call it 5 years plus down the track, the question is if you want to wait until then or if you want to meanwhile park your cash somewhere that's actually generating income, and then 5 years down the track you can recycle, sell the property, buy a new one with a loan, or by that time you might have accrued enough to just expand to be able to pay half of the cost on your own and so forth.
Well, and I think that brings back to the sort of difference in Australian-Japanese mentality. So here, we buy a house. We don't think, oh, I'm going to live in this for the next 30 years and pay off the mortgage. Like, I guess some people do. Mm-hmm. But, we might hold it for 2-3 years. We've got good capital growth. We sell it. We move somewhere else. We start another job somewhere else.
So two caveats there from the Japanese perspective. The first off is that if you sell within the first 5 years, there's double capital gains tax. And the second is there's probably not going to be that much capital gains in any case, right? Japan being Japan, unless you're buying in super central locations, I'd say at the moment maybe central Tokyo, central Osaka, central Fukuoka would be about it. Maybe places that are close enough to enjoy the same fundamentals, so Kawasaki, Kobe, maybe central Yokohama, although we haven't seen huge price jumps there in the last 5, 6 years. But they're close enough to Tokyo to enjoy the similar fundamentals. But you would assume that it's not going to be, I mean, the flipping game is, it's done here by companies that specialize in that. So they buy cheap, renovate cheaply, and then sell at a slight profit. But it's not due to capital gains, it's just due to the way that they practice it. Flipping for capital gains profit is not really a strategy that I would bank on here. It's great if there are capital gains, but I definitely wouldn't count on it happening.
Yes, yeah, I understand all that. But I guess in the Japanese situation, well, in my particular situation, the other half is worried, if we sort of say buy in Osaka or Kyoto or somewhere, and we're locked thinking that, oh, we're locked there, we have to stay there for 30 years until, the loan finishes. Whereas I'm saying, well, no, we can still, stay there for 5 years or whatever time, and then we sell that, and then we move on. Like we're not locked in into that property
Are
at the
you talking
moment.
about your own home now or the investment property?
Either.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
So.
with the investment, I mean, a home loan is a home loan. I mean, owner-occupied property is an owner-occupied property in the sense that if you're comfortable living in that location, you want to stay, you stay, and if your life requirements change, then you move on. With investment properties, I can tell you that most of our clients are strictly buy and hold. And the only reason they would be selling is A, if they for some reason urgently need money elsewhere, and most of them are pretty savvy investors, so not many of them are in that spot. And the other reason would be if the building is getting slightly older, maintenance costs are rising to a point where the yield is just not too attractive anymore. And the same goes if you own individual units, then monthly building fees will go up to cover for maintenance. And if you own the entire building, then your out-of-pocket maintenance costs will get higher. So it's kind of the same thing. At that point, then yes, they would sell them and just invest that money in something a little bit younger. And the time frame for that is usually somewhere between 7 to 10 years, I'd say.
Yes.
And look, some of them are, they've gotten, if they've gotten very good results from the property, they're just happy to ride it till it drops and just hang on to it until it's at the point where it needs to be torn down. We haven't been there yet with any customer, but there are some that just keep on holding to them even as they get older and older. But most of them, I mean, we would send out an advisory, look, your property is reaching the point where we think it might be a good idea to try and sell it now before costs get too high or the price falls off a cliff, and then they just make a decision based on that.
Well, and I, as you mentioned in one of your episodes, it's far better just basically parking your cash in Japanese property and getting even a 3% return. It's better than any bank at the
Yeah,
moment. So.
yeah. And if the location is very attractive, then Japanese investors will always take it off your hands because they're not as concerned about yields. One, because they don't need to consider any exchange rate fluctuations and so forth. And B, because again, mentality-wise, even the ones who are investing in Japan, it's very rare that they actually are aware of the fact that they could invest elsewhere and get higher returns. They're just very insular in that sense. So there's always, I mean, we would always be able to sell a property that our customers wouldn't want to buy, would always be able to sell to a Japanese investor.
And as you've mentioned before, it all comes down to those just, market fundamentals. If you're going to be buying in the middle of nowhere, it's going to be harder to sell, whether and compared to being in a more desirable place with good employment, it seems the world over.
With investment properties, they're really judged strictly on the yield that they can generate. So if there's been a tenant in there for a good long time and there haven't been huge gaps between tenants and the property is still yielding, and even if it's very suburban or in a rural area but with, reasonably good industry or population trends, it would still be easy to sell. But if you're selling it vacant, or if you're selling something that's too old and needs major renovation, then they'll obviously, whoever buys it will want to, seriously discount the price.
Yes, well, I see there is a newsletter going around that people can subscribe to. I won't mention what it's called, but basically highlighting how you can get some very low cost properties in Japan.
Oh, Cheap Houses Japan, yeah. We're in partnership with them, actually. They refer quite a few clients to us. I would say that those are usually geared towards people who are looking for a property for their own personal use. And once they contact us, if they start asking us if we can buy this property and turn it into an investment, then we have to give them a bit of a cold shower and let them know that that's not going to be a viable investment property. But sometimes you can get something for that same price. It's just not going to be a beautiful old house. It's going to be a tiny little condo in a good location that's going to be generating yield for that same level of investment.
The cash cows, as you call them, definitely. I guess my concern, not so much a concern, but just a question. So say, I did buy somewhere one of these 1K places. After a 10-year period, you want to sell it. What sort of depreciation and capital value can I expect? I know how long's a piece of string, but...
Well, assuming that we've purchased with a bit of forward thinking, so for example, these days we wouldn't recommend to buy anything that's older than 30 years, exactly for that reason, because as they get closer to 40 years, they tend to, it's not a tax depreciation factor. It's more a case of owners thinking about the maintenance costs that would be going up, potential buyers. So as long as we focus on a basically good, stable location and the property that's not too old, we're assuming that the yield wouldn't have dropped too much by the time that you want to sell it. So you can basically assume that if yield has gone down by 1%, whoever's buying it will want to discount the price so that it goes back up to that attractive yield percentage again. Mm-hmm. And here as well, the easiest course for us and our clients is always to sell to another client. So if the property is priced properly and is still generating a reasonable yield, you might be able to get the same price for it or even higher if that location is now particularly attractive. And for example, in Fukuoka, people are not expecting the 8 or 9% that they had 7-8 years ago. They're now expecting 4 or 5%. So it could be that you could actually be selling at a profit if the location has become increasingly popular. Otherwise, probably around the same price, maybe slightly lower, say 10-20% lower. But hopefully by that time, your rental income, assuming that, again, you're maybe selling 7, 8, 9 years down the track, your rental income has probably already given you more than 50 or 60% of the capital back. So you're still very well in the green, even if it sells at a slight discount. I'd say on average, most of our clients resell at roughly about the same price that they've purchased at. Fundamentals in most cities in Japan haven't changed significantly. People who have sold in hotspots like Fukuoka, or if for some reason they got a good deal in central Tokyo, Osaka, have sold at a profit. Everybody else, just about the same amount. The people who have lost on capital is people who, for some reason, have had to reduce the rent because there was, severe competition from new buildings in the area, or the population trends for that particular city have changed and rent is just now lower there. Or people who are selling vacant properties or properties that they haven't renovated after the last tenant moved out, for whatever reason, because they don't want to put more capital into it, or because they're just fire selling for any reason. It's rare, but it does happen sometimes. And those might have lost anywhere between 5 to, at worst, 20%, I'd say.
Yeah, it's obviously just a very different situation to, well, definitely currently Australia.
Yeah, but I mean, look, the cash flow here is nowhere. I mean, Australia is nowhere near the cash flow that you can get here. I mean, I remember when we liquidated our last Australian holdings, they were making on a good year maybe 3.5-4% in rental income. And depending on the period, like we liquidated it in, I think, 2013. And between 2009 to 2013, prices were just not going anywhere because it was a global financial crisis. COVID might create similar dynamics. And so it really depends on the time at which you're liquidating. Here you can pretty much count on the fact that you're not going to see any capital growth, but the sort of, not guaranteed, but the far more stable rental income is always there.
Well, and as you quite eloquently have put before, there's not going to be any drug labs or wild parties or
It's
things
very
in
much a
the.
hassle-free investment. Australia is not that bad in that regard. It's not the US. But I
No.
mean, look, payment problems do exist in Australia more than they do here. And kicking a tenant out, while again, it's not as difficult as it is in the States, is a lot easier here. You send them a letter and they're gone, basically. And they also stay longer. I think your average Australian tenant tends to stay in place maybe 2-3 years. Here, even the singles stay in place somewhere between 4 to 5 years on average. Families can stay in the same place. Families, or let's say middle-aged females, for example, would stay in the same place for even 20 years. So it's basically a lot more passive investment-wise.
Oh yeah, and it's, as I said, I think if people are open to the Japanese industry and realizing how it works, there's a lot of very, very positive things that are major detractors in, let's say, other Western countries.
It depends on the rest of your portfolio too. Like you mentioned, you've got properties in Brisbane that are probably very different fundamentally than what you've got here in Japan. So there's a bit of a diversity play to be made there as well. Have some of it more speculative, some of it more safe and stable, spreading them out geographically, obviously, socioeconomically, and so forth.
Yes, well, like Brisbane's just gone crazy. So I had an apartment in basically inner city Brisbane, and yeah, it's just appreciated unbelievably, and it's just become almost well, you wouldn't be making anything for renting it out. It's just the rental yield is it's nothing compared to the property value. So it's not worth holding unless you're living in it basically.
But you've purchased it cheaper, I assume, yeah?
Yes,
Yeah.
yes. So, well, I've actually have liquidated that now. I've sold that.
Okay.
So I'm was happy to do that. I got in and out at the right times, which is pretty rare, but.
I mean, the other thing to be said for Japan is that if your property was anything similar to what we liquidated in Australia, for that price, you can probably buy 5 or 6 of them here, which again offers a lot more diversity. I mean, obviously, multiple income streams is better than having a single one. And again, you spread them out geographically, socioeconomically. I mean, just the fact that you can buy a building, a multi-unit building in Japan for the price of a condo unit in Australia is, that was what convinced me from the get-go to move my funds here.
Yes. Well, you really are the landlord in that situation, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's oh yeah, it's very interesting. But yeah, I guess for a local Japanese person, just a regular person, that sort of seems a bridge too far. They don't understand it. They think it's a huge risk. Whereas,
Well,
I've
somebody from your wife's generation, most of them are like that. But the Ojiichan Obaachan and the elderly folks who have lived through a few boom and bust cycles are very savvy investors here. That's most of the people that we buy our properties from, are either real estate companies that do that for a living, or 70, 80-year-olds who, they're getting there and their children are similar again to the younger generation. The children are, no, we don't want the property. Just give us cash. So they sell, and we're happy with that. We're buying. But they're and Japan has more and more of these elderly people as the population ages, so there's good competition here to be had, and there's savvy people, but not the younger generations yet.
No, they don't seem to have sort of come on board.
So I guess if you've been through World War II, economic bubble bursting doesn't seem that scary anymore, right?
No, not at all.
We interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say this. We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, or if you just need summer quiet to hide away from the world. So they offer a variety of options for families, for corporate relocations, or simply if you're transitioning between homes in Tokyo. Now, the properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They've got fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, a fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but long-term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profits, or a holiday home that you want rented out when not in use via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth your visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at emil.gorgies, GORGEES, at tokyorealty.jp.
Not at all. And, you know, having been going to and from Japan for over 20 years, there's lots of positives there, particularly from people who would be renting, that you just don't get overseas. So what about in terms of a personal property, like a home to live in? I can't sort of see the merit in coming over and paying 6 months of rent somewhere when I could be paying 6 months of mortgage. That's my mentality.
Well, I would say if you can get a mortgage, it's a no-brainer, right? So if you're, and I'm guessing your wife might be a bit happier signing off on a homeowner mortgage than she would with an investment property. So if you do have access to getting a Japanese mortgage, it's virtually a no-brainer, paying 0.5% or 0.7% in interest for a home is, of course, you'd want to do that. As to where, I guess it would depend on where and what sort of property you're looking at. So it might not make that much sense to buy something in Roppongi Towers, but if you're talking about Yokohama again, for example, or if you're talking about something a bit more suburban in Tokyo or in Osaka, then they're not that expensive, especially if you're not buying brand new.
Yeah.
They can be very affordable, again, compared to Australia, for sure.
It would be Kyoto.
In Kyoto, okay. Kyoto, central Kyoto can be not cheap. But if you're happy with suburban, it's doable, yeah.
Yeah, no, the burbs are fine. But yeah, that's sort of, to me, that's a no-brainer. You just have to do the basic calculations, and it's a no-brainer. But again, it's just that sort of that mentality that, oh no, we don't buy, we rent. And it's sort of changing that way of thinking.
That's very old school. I mean, most Japanese younger couples and families that I know are very happy to take out a mortgage and buy a home to live in as soon as they can afford it.
Yeah, she's from a very traditional family.
Okay.
And just, I guess, Just a different way of thinking, and I think it's more about, oh well, you know, we sign up for a mortgage that we're sticking here until it's all paid off in 30 years sort of time, whereas I'm like, well, we could just buy it in cash and then stay a couple of years
or move out and rent it out. That's doable too.
Exactly. That's the sort of real difficult thing with Japan as opposed to Australia, because you know we can build that equity and then duplicate and get another property and another, but it just can't be done.
No.
From my understanding.
No, you can resell or rent it out. That's pretty much the only strategies available for exit. Or again, tear it down and do something else with the land plot.
Yes, and yeah, you can't use that at all to purchase another property.
No. Okay. I mean, you will be able. Like basically the banks limit your borrowing capacity depending on how much you've already borrowed. You will be able to let them know that you're planning to move to another property and resell this one. So they'll reset your borrowing capacity and let you borrow again for the new home. But then within about 6 months, they'll want to see that you've actually sold this one, so that you can, so that your borrowing capacity is real. But it's not really drawing on equity. It's just them letting you roll over the loan to a different property as an owner-occupier. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Because there's very sort of strict limits on what you can borrow. And I guess to your earlier point, at this stage, in terms of loans, it wouldn't be me. It would have to be my wife. And I'm basically just coming to the party with the cash. So,
yep.
So I guess, you know, I could front half the cash and she could get a loan for the rest. Really, that's probably the easiest.
If she's got a stable income history, then yeah, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and basically just keeping me out of the process.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, from the perspective of the banks, has she been living here for long, or have you been living in Australia for a few years and just come back here?
She's been back for about a year now.
That should be sufficient. And she's been working all of that year?
Yes.
So she should definitely be eligible for a loan, I would say.
Mm.
Yeah, unless she's on... is she a saishin, an actually salaried employee, or is she a contractor?
Salaried employee.
Yeah, so she should be fine. She should be able to borrow up to seven times her annual salary.
Yeah, so, well, of course, she's also in Australia. We were in Australia for a couple of years, but, you know, before that, in Japan as well. Okay. Well, I guess parking lots is the other thing. Like, I know we've mentioned about, you know, having a building gets old and knocking it down, putting it into a parking lot. I did listen to your podcast, and I think read an article that you've written for an Asian newspaper about it, and there was a company that you linked to. Is it viable just to try and buy an existing car park as opposed to going through, I guess, the more difficult steps of having a land or a building, knocking it down, building it, all that sort of thing? Is there?
I mean, it's more involved setting it up from scratch, but it will be cheaper in the long term. If you buy an existing one, then again, it's going to be priced based on the income that it generates.
Yeah.
Whereas if you buy a land plot, it's, you know, whoever is selling it to you is assuming that you're going to have construction costs, so they're priced accordingly. But with parking lots, if you wanted to even come close to what you can get from standard residential or commercial investment, you'll want to get something fairly central, and you'll want to put at least a two-story parking structure on it. Otherwise, you're scratching the 2.5%, maybe 3% again, which you could get even in central Tokyo with a good property. So,
yeah.
And most people who don't do that, people who just buy a land plot and just single-level parking set up on it, are usually just land banking. They're just waiting for value to potentially go up and then flip the land again. It's not really a cash flow oriented initiative unless you're buying, again, fairly central, reasonably close to a station or a very popular residential area, and two floor structure with a boom gate. And that's when you can start making reasonable yields on it.
Yeah, the setup cost for that would be quite substantial, I'd imagine. Not.
It's usually a concrete structure if you want to be running cars up and down it. So yeah, it's not going to be as cheap as building it. It could get away with maybe about the price of a fancy house. So maybe $300,000 for construction. But then if you bought fairly good location land, there's going to be at least $300,000-$400,000 on top of that for the land, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, so you could be getting to $1 million pretty quickly, basically.
Close to it, I'd say. Yeah, somewhere between seven to nine, maybe. Yeah.
Mm.
Unless you happen to hit a spot that's really hasn't risen up in value, but you definitely know that the fundamentals of the area means that it will. So there will, you're estimating that there will be a demand for parking services in this area, but it hasn't gone to that level quite yet. But those spots, especially in Japan, where, I mean, locations are pretty stable industry and population wise, that's hard to pick. I wouldn't be able to tell you with any certainty that I know of any spots like that at the moment. When it happens, it's usually a surprise to most people.
Of course.
I mean, we might see, like, for example, I could tell you in Fukuoka City, which is still growing in size and value, then I can tell you that there are a few suburbs where you might be able to buy something cheap, and that they could potentially, because if I see urban rejuvenation one station up the track, then I know that the next station is probably going to be next in line. But as to how quickly that might happen, that's a bit of a mystery to me as well, even living here. So I can tell you that, yeah, next to this station is a good place to buy, but whether it's going to start yielding within 2 years or 5 years or 7 years, I don't know.
Well, that's the gamble.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a recommended number of properties in a portfolio like this? What's good to manage? When does it become too difficult?
Well, if you or your wife or you or your company staff are going to be managing them on their own, then it's a matter of your personal bandwidth, how much monthly decisions you can make, how many monthly communication with property managers and asset managers you want to have. If you're dealing with a single point of contact, like if you're working with someone like us, for example, I'd say the more the merrier, because it gives you more diversity, right? But I wouldn't buy bottom end properties just to get a higher amount of doors. Like, I wouldn't focus my entire portfolio on 20,000-30,000 yen tiny apartments in secondary cities. I'd probably add a minimum. I mean, look, depends on your budget. If you can afford to, I would probably focus on as many small buildings as you can, because again of the flexibility that inherent in them and the potential capital growth with a bigger land parcel. Otherwise, I would maybe go for as many individual units as you can, but try to go for something that's 50,000-60,000 per unit and upwards. It just gives you better locations and better tenant profiles.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, as you've mentioned before, the diversity is the key. They're just diversifying against all sorts of things, from market conditions to natural disasters.
Yeah, but there's a limit. Look, if we're happy to service anyone, so we get a lot of people who just, you know, they've saved 20,000-40,000 US and they just want to have some kind of real estate property that's generating some kind of income anywhere. So we're happy to help them. But if you've got the budget to work wider than that, I wouldn't focus on the bottom end of the market if you can, because getting 100 doors, but they're all low profile tenants in out of the way locations, I mean, they'll generate income until they don't, and then they'll sort of die off. I'd much rather focus on slightly lower number of properties, but slightly higher profile properties and higher profile tenants. If you can. If you can't, then yeah, we'll cater to whatever people ask for. It's still, I mean, look, at least in Japan, you can invest 20, 30, 40,000 and actually get some rental income. It's not really feasible unless you're buying into ghetto properties in the US, and then that's not really stable income in any sense of the word. But at least here, it's an option for people who want it. But if you can, I'd aim for higher, yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know. Well, that's all very interesting. But yeah, so I guess basically the big takeaway from what you're saying is, if I wanted to get into the property market today, I've basically got to come with the cash.
Yep.
And there are no sort of creative strategies that are going to be worthwhile.
Well, it depends on interest rates in Australia. What's the rates on a personal loan or a business credit line in Australia at the moment? Are the interest rates attractive?
Well, don't know them off the top of my head at this particular point in time, but I imagine they're slightly down, but probably, you know, too high considering what the market conditions are. Definitely not as good as Japan. We might be, personal loan might be 5.7% or something like that.
Well, then you do run the slight risk of going into negative gearing territory if and when you get some vacancies or maintenance or something unexpected happens. You could, even if we aim from the, I mean, at the time of purchase, we might be able to get to 6-7%. But that's 6-7% before tax, and that's going to drop whenever something happens, right? So unless Japan takes a huge economic leap forward and salaries go up and rents go up, which we haven't seen in the last decade, then we can safely assume that yield will go down over time rather than up. And then you're a little bit too close to the interest rate for comfort, I'd say.
Yes, I agree. Well, speaking of salaries going up, I've obviously in the news recently, Japanese Prime Minister's suggesting to companies that they pay more,
Abe-san's been suggesting that to companies since he came into office in 2012. I've yet to see it happen, and he had a lot more clout than Kishida does.
Well, he's even got Abenomics named after him.
I mean, that was a lot of feel-good stuff for a good few years, but I mean, look, Japan's doing really well considering the population trend here, right? Like, to have any sort of economic growth when your workforce is shrinking is phenomenal. But I don't see any huge, I mean, look, when policies change, and I don't think companies will be paying higher salaries unless they get anything out of it. And they're as conservative as your typical Japanese spouse, right? So the only real way forward that I can see is either wide opening of the immigration gates, like Hiroshi Mikitani from Rakuten has been giving them a lot of hard talk about that, or a huge shift in mind frames towards females, which will actually encourage them to have a career and work more and have more babies. And, you know, basically Japanese women are kind of voting with their wombs to not have too many babies because they're not interested in being a house slave. Until they change the basic fundamentals to enable them to be happier about having babies, then I don't think the population trend. So it's either immigration or birth rates, and I don't see any major policies that are going to be improving any of those two. And as long as that doesn't improve, the economy is going to keep stagnant, right? It's growing to some degree when things are doing well, but it's not any significant growth. So salaries don't grow, rents don't go up, and then we can assume that investment yields will keep going down as buildings age. Yeah, so they might be higher at the time of purchase, but they're not going to go higher because you can raise the rent. They're going to go lower because maintenance is going to become more expensive, which is again why people sell them after 7-8 years or one.
Yeah, so I guess an example of yield dropping. So let's say you are getting 7% on year one. By year 10, what are we looking at? Down below 5%?
Probably about that. So 5.5-ish, 5% after about 10 years. Our clients tend to sell when it drops below 5% most of the time. And that's again net pre-tax. So your first few properties are going to be probably tax-free if they're smaller condo units, or at least tax-free for the first 3 or 5 years, depending on whether you buy them as an individual or as a business. But after that, once you start paying tax, so it depends on your tax liabilities in Japan. If you're living in Japan and you've got other income in Japan, you could be paying slightly higher income tax. I mean, it's not as high as in Australia, nowhere near that. But you could, I mean, I'd probably safe to assume that once you start paying income tax, maybe about 1% lower, the yield goes maybe 1% lower, 1.5%, depending on how much you're making here.
Yeah, well, I see on your website there's a lot of information about tax, and it's on first read it's a bit of a minefield, sort of navigating it all.
That's what accountants are for. I wouldn't even presume to be able to work that out on my own.
Why didn't I do accounting at university?
Nah, it takes
That's
a
boring.
certain mindset to be an accountant. It's like a computer programmer. I admire the people who can actually do that. But there are good accountants in Japan, even bilingual, so that's not a huge issue, and they're quite affordable.
Yeah, so accountants in Australia, they're very expensive at the moment. Navigating with all the coronavirus payments, all that sort of thing, I'm sure it's almost saved the industry.
Our customers who have only property income in Japan, so people like you while you're remote and not making any income here, so people who only have property income in Japan, the accountant that they usually work with charges, I think, 7,500 yen per annum per property, to do the
Wow.
tax returns, or maybe 100 if it's a couple. So $100 if it's a couple. Per property. So considering that that's less than half a month of rent, it's very much worth putting it in, I think.
Well, seeing in Australia, you mentioned that it's a business tax return and they put $5,000 on it before they get started. So, wow, that's well, that's another positive for everyone listening. Cheap accounting rates, wow.
Cost of living being lower is always a good thing if you're living here.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that was all my questions.
So just
Okay. Is it?
go for it.
Do you think it's more advantageous to have the property portfolio as a company or as an individual in Japan?
If you're going to be purchasing assets, this is just a rough figure, but if you're going to be purchasing assets that are over half a million US or maybe closer to 700,000 US, and that's when tax advantages for companies become a thing. Otherwise, to set up a local branch and upkeep it every year, so you need to pay accounting and bookkeeping fees every year, and that's going to be at a minimum about $3,000. If you include the minimum corporate tax, so even if you're not having any official taxable income, you still need to pay a minimum corporate tax of at least somewhere between 700 to 1,000 US. So that doesn't make sense unless your annual income is at least 30, 40,000. I mean, you don't want to pay more than 10% of your costs in accounting and bookkeeping and taxes.
No.
And that sort of income would be generated from properties that are at least half a million US and upwards. So probably higher than that, but there are some other, I mean, you can claim more deductions as a company than you would as an individual. So even if you're not making quite as much, even if you're not making the 30, 40,000 US, maybe you bought a small building for, let's say, half a million US, and it's generating, let's say, something like 25,000 per annum. It might make sense because there's more that you can claim as deductions. But below half a million worth of assets, I'd say no.
No.
No. Unless, again, unless you've already got a company in Japan, you're already paying company upkeep costs, and there are other factors coming into play and other expenses that you want to offset against, then that's something that an accountant can definitely advise on. But if the company is only being set up for the purpose of property investment, I'd say that's the bottom limit.
Yes. Okay. That's interesting. Because I know in Australia it's you basically got to say what your company's primary business stream is, and if you're trying to sort of say, oh, you know, we've got some property, and you know, we have a restaurant, and we do these sorts of things, it gets very difficult, and I don't think the government likes that too much.
They
So
don't care about that here.
I don't care about that.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Single holding company can do a
Do it
very
all.
wide variety of business, yeah.
Great. Last question, sorry. What about commercial property?
That's the only place where we can potentially raise the rents if the economy does well, or if at least the local economy in that location does well. Because an established business that's making a good income in a good location would want to stay there, so they wouldn't mind paying more.
Yes.
So those leases can be renegotiated on renewal. But the other side of that same token is that when the economy doesn't do as well, commercial properties tend to be a lot more volatile and suffer more than residential properties. So no one's going to be, there's not going to be massive layoffs and salary reductions in Japan. Somebody who's got a reasonably stable job is probably going to be a residential tenant even when crisis hits. But companies can and do relocate, downsize, go out of business. So the rents can fluctuate as much downwards as they can be raised. So I would say if you're just starting out an investment portfolio, it would be a good idea to have, depending on your risk appetite, let's say about at least half of it stable residential, probably slightly lower yield, good location sort of thing. Then have another maybe 20% more adventurous residential, maybe smaller cities with potentially higher yields. And the rest of it, 20-30% maybe in commercial. And obviously play with those borderlines as befitting your risk appetite, but I wouldn't. Having said that, there are very big investors out there that specialize and only invest in commercial, right? They're safe and stable in commercial as well. If you buy a central Tokyo office building for a few million bucks, then yields are very low, but you're always going to have tenants who are looking to rent there. So similar dynamics. But if you're talking about your typical commercial at you and my level, so small shops, maybe a small building where units can be used for both residential or office purposes, a small office building or a small shopping center, at that level, I would say it can be more volatile. So I would probably aim towards allocating a smaller part of your portfolio to those. Unless you're the very adventurous type, obviously.
I'm an economic conservative, but from time to time I have a higher risk appetite.
Yeah, that's why we have 10-20%, same here. 10-20% of our portfolio does go towards these higher risk ventures. But I'm very similar to, I like to see a steady paycheck and then get adventurous with the bonuses.
Yes, absolutely. Because I guess as you said, with residential, times are bad, they're going to stay there, but
In Japan, for sure.
in Japan,
Yeah.
but with the commercial things turn sour, you may be looking at a long period of an unoccupied asset, which is just costing you money and not generating you any.
Yes, and also bear in mind that for a Japanese company to declare bankruptcy has a lot less stigma than for a Japanese individual to declare bankruptcy. They're going to do their best to pay their debts, whereas a company going out of business will, even in Japan, will happily declare bankruptcy to avoid debt. So that's still not as much of an issue as it is in other countries, but still an issue.
Oh yeah, and because in Australia, there's obviously been a huge change in the last 24 months with commercial property, because it was something that I was becoming very interested in, and now everyone's working from home. Like it's just become such a common thing. There's these empty central cities, just people working from home, and
That
it's not.
trend is very much, it exists here since COVID struck, but it's very, the vast majority of the population here are blue collar workers or salespeople that still need to get into the city. So they might move to the suburbs as opposed to the central city, but moving out to the countryside to work from home is something that only really the higher echelon can afford here.
Still exists in the land of fiction, I guess.
Yeah. It is a bit of a trend, like it's definitely happening. And the other thing is that a lot of, I mean, companies that can afford to have sort of liquidated a central city big headquarter office and instead of that opted for a few satellite offices in the suburbs to make it easier for people who do want to be closer to home now to commute into smaller offices on the once or twice a week that they do that now. So when they can, they have definitely relegated people to working from home. And that's also created a bit of a higher demand for larger floor prints in the house because you suddenly need an office space. But central city commercial properties are not going anywhere. Retail is suffering. So shops are definitely feeling the pain. There's a huge shift to e-commerce here. But offices are very much still a thing. They're not going anywhere.
Yeah, it's, well, I hope it doesn't go anywhere. It's, you know, that's sort of a bit of a charm of Japan, well, particularly, you know, the shopping streets and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't go too online. Yeah. Well, I could keep talking for hours about all this, but you're a busy man, so...
I do need eventually to move ahead with the rest of the day, but it's been a real pleasure. I enjoy these deeper dives. And so I guess, just to summarize, I think, if I understand correctly, where you are now is, A, you need to have a few conversations with your spouse and see where she stands on the loan situations, both for investment loans and homeowner loans. And then once that's done and you have a better idea of how much capital you're going to be putting in and when, you'll probably need to decide when to pull the trigger, right? Whether it's going to be only once you qualify for a loan or if you want to start with cash and then sort of convert to a mixed loan cash structure, right?
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, I can come right now with the cash and buy things, but again, being, you know, economically conservative, I would prefer to only use some of that cash and then sort of bridge it with a loan.
Yeah.
Bridge the rest with a loan. That's, I think, the sort of smarter thing to do for my situation at this point in time.
Well, only if you can put that cash somewhere that's actually making any cash in the interim, right?
Well, fortunately, the share market hasn't been doing too poorly in recent times.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, so as long as you've got places to park it until that time, that's definitely the wisest course, I think.
It is, but yeah, you know, I'm looking at, you know, relocating hopefully next month and, you know, being there long term, and I just think it makes sense to, you know, but banks are just such a terrible place to give you money.
That's not even an option. But look, I would say if you're going to be using your relationship credits and applying any sort of pressure, I would definitely aim for the home loan first, because that's really a no-brainer. I mean, definitely there's a case to be made to your wife that you're absolutely throwing money away every month, especially with moving costs in Japan if you're renting, and just explain to her that the fact that the mortgage is there for 30 years, A, it doesn't mean that you actually have to keep living there. You can definitely rent it out or resell it if you want to move out. And even if you then just approach the bank and just change that loan over to an investment loan, if they'll allow it at that point, or even just pay it off. I mean, you've obviously got the cash to pay it off. I'm guessing you're not going to be buying a Heart of Tokyo penthouse apartment for like $4 million, something a bit more reasonable. So as long as you've got the cash to pay it off, then you're completely free to leave at any time. And it just doesn't make sense, even if it's for 10 years, to throw away that kind of money every month.
Oh, absolutely. And because we haven't even mentioned all of these other upfront costs with renting in Japan, the key money, guarantee money, all this sort of thing, which can be, what, up to 7 months rent just down the toilet for no reason.
Yeah.
So,
especially in Kyoto, it definitely can be like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a no-brainer. So,
I would apply pressure there first and just start the investment conversation maybe a little bit later.
Yes, I might have to keep a few of those thoughts to myself for the time being. Well, thank you very much, my friend, and so lovely to speak to a kindred soul about all of this and someone
here.
who really loves and appreciates the whole industry.
Same here. Pleasure speaking with you.
We'll be in touch soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So as advertised, nice, long, deep dive into a bunch of property investment topics. Hope you found some value in the conversation. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead.